Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's working? Okay. So my name is Michał Dubiel. I work for SemiHalf, and I've got short status about our recent work of bringing OpenStack and OpenContrail for support for FreeBSD hosts. I'll take them in two parts. I think I'll talk a bit about OpenStack, and then later on about OpenContrail, and the summary, I hope I'll be able to show you some live demo of working system we do have in our lab. So let's start about the OpenStack. I don't know if everyone is familiar with this. I suppose yes, but let me do a short introduction. Guys from OpenStack call themselves that they are a massively scalable cloud operating system, and in some terms, it's true because we do have our FreeBSD system, which manages resources available on the platform it's run. They have the OpenStack, which manages resources which are available in the cloud they are trying to deal with. And there are three major areas that OpenStack tries to deal with, and this is compute power, storage, and network. It composed of many components, but the main components for these three areas are Nova for compute power, Swift and Cinder for block and object storage, and Neutron for networking. I highlighted here in blue those parts which we actually touched during our development. At first we want to have some functionality of the compute node made available for FreeBSD. So as I mentioned, there are many components that OpenStack consists of. And it is a distributed system, so each of these components may be run on different server actually. And our interest is on the components that are necessary for the compute node. We choose to start from the compute node for the two main reasons. One is that this is the most common one role, because you can have a controller and one controller and many compute nodes that actually spawn the VMs and host the VMs. And this is the one that is most dependent on the underlying OS platform. Because every component in OpenStack is actually written in Python, so those should be easily runnable on FreeBSD or Linux and other platforms. But there are some tricky parts, especially in the compute node components that uses some other specific things that have to be just ported to FreeBSD, and that's what we actually did in terms of OpenStack. We needed at least two processes to be run and to be functional on FreeBSD. The first and the most important one is Nova Compute, which actually manages the VM instances that are being run on the particular compute node. It is responsible for running them, terminating, attaching, detaching volumes for the VM and for the console output. Along with this, which we had implemented a FreeBSD version of Nova Network component, which allows for simple solutions for making virtual networks between the VMs. We need this because our main goal was, of course, to have OpenContrail managing all networking stuff inside our cluster. But to enable further development, we have to have something, and we developed the initial version of Nova Network component for FreeBSD. This only provides simple solutions, like you have one bridge for each virtual network, you can put there your top, which represents interfaces to the VMs. If some of the VMs are on the other compute node, then you can isolate private networks using VLANs, etc. But we don't support all these features. I'll outline what is not supported and what is later on. In terms of development we had to do in order to bring up compute nodes, OpenStack compute nodes on FreeBSD host, the most important was connection from the Nova compute to the hypervisor. And Nova compute uses libvirt for that purpose. And thanks to Roman Bogorodsky's work, who implemented the initial version of Beehive support for FreeBSD, we added our few new features and fixes for that in order to make Nova be able to use Beehive via the libvirt on the host. And putting it all together, we could easily spawn or terminate the instance. We could do what actually libvirt and Beehive allowed us to do at the moment. And that was not much work in terms of the Nova compute. The Nova network required some more work because there were many, I would say, Linuxisms hard-coded, like using special tools which are not available on FreeBSD or touching ProzFS. And we just had to implement our new FreeBSD net module, which is just a version of Linux net module, which is available in the original Nova repository, and we just implemented this. But along with those two components, we have to deal with setting all this up, and there is a special DevStack called script. It is also maintained by the OpenStack community, which is used to provision all this, to configure, to run and to install, configure and run all the processes which are necessary for OpenStack to function properly. And that was not very pleasant work because in the DevStack there are many hard-coded things, and it is not difficult at all, but it's just not pleasant work. But we have to do this, and we have our support for DevStack, which can bring up a compute node on the FreeBSD host. So the current state with the OpenStack is that we basically allows what the libvirt allows us to do on the compute node. And libvirt is dependent on what Beehive allows it to do. And for the Nova network, we support only simple bridged networks. They call them FLAD or FLAD DHCP in the OpenStack nomenclatures. And we do not have firewall driver or do not support VLANs. This is our next steps we would like to do. This is those are not very difficult to implement, but we have our own priorities, and after we enabled OpenStack to run, we switched to development of the open control solution, which we are mostly interested in. And but the code base is ready and can be quite easily extended to new features. And what we want to do next in terms of Nova or OpenStack is to continue libvirt development, because this is the piece that is the most important in providing new functionalities for the Nova. We want to implement some of the firewall driver. It has not been yet decided which one it should be. And we want to implement memory device support, because there is only a loop device which is Linux equivalent, and it is important, because if you spawn VM inside some security groups and you have your SSH keys, for instance, in those security groups, then just before the VM is spawned, the key are injected into the VM image, and it can be used, but this is not supported at the moment on the FreeBSD hosted compute nodes. And I'll now move on into the OpenCon trail. And I'll also like to start from a quick introduction. And in one word, this is just a complete solution that provides network virtualization. It's done by Juniper Networks, and there are many ways you can implement virtual networks. They choose to use the overlying networks for this purpose, and they claim they are a complete SDN solution. In terms, they have their own SDN controller. It's centralized controller, but it's logically centralized and physically is distributed, which allows for easy scalability. So it's good in that, and it also uses standard-based protocols, which helps them to intercooperate with other network equipment you or any cloud provider can have in their setups. So it is similarly to the OpenStack. It also it is also distributed system, and it also has some node roles that each node plays different role in the entire setup. And we also started from implementing the compute node for the same reasons like for OpenStack. But let's start from the top. At the very top is the configuration node, which exposes REST API, which is used actually by the OpenStack Neutron plugin, which talks using this API whenever new virtual network is being created or new VM is being spawned. This information is provided into the OpenCon trail system via this API, and it holds the persistent state of the network. So if you have some number of virtual networks, a number of VMs, and you know which VMs should be connected to what particular network, what policy should be, this all is held in this persistent database in the configuration node. Just below is the control node, which holds the ephemeral state. The ephemeral state is, for instance, if some VM migrates from one compute node host to another compute host, then this state is held in this base because the entire system has to know how to configure the vRouter, where the packets should be sent when they are where the destination is some particular VM. And control node also is a BGP compliant, so it can federate with other control nodes and also other physical routers, gateways, or any equipment you can have in your setup. And control node uses XMPP to exchange information with the compute node. So if the configuration is held decided in high level description of the network, you have only policies between the virtual networks, information which VM should be in which virtual network, but the control node then translated into a more lower level representation, which is then easier in the compute node to transform eventually into the forwarding base, information base. So this control node does this translation and broadcasts this information to the compute nodes using XMPP. And the compute node is composed of two things. One is the agent. It's the agent in the OpenStack Neutrons nomenclature, so it just manages. It is a user space application, which manages synchronize the state of the network with the kernel, with the vRouter kernel module, which actually implements all the features at the lower level, and the agent also communicates with Nova virtual interface plugin. It is like when the VM is spawned, then the information about which tab belongs to which VMs is, for instance, communicated using to the agent directly from the Nova compute to the agent host. And agent also does every flow discovery where there is new flow not known, and the routing table has no entries for that flow in the kernel, then the agent is asked for that. Agent knows these informations from the controller nodes and set up correct entries in the kernel in the vRouter model. So let me talk a bit about how it works. I think the best would be to just go through some example. We do have here two compute nodes. Each compute node have its own vRouter, and those compute nodes are connected by the physical network. OOP Control calls them IP fabric, and there's all those switches S1 and S2, which somehow provides connectivity, physical connectivity between these two compute nodes. And each virtual network is represented in each virtual router as a routing instance. And let's say we have VM1A, those on the left, wants to say a packet to VM2A, which is on the compute node 2, but those two VMs are on the same virtual network. So everything starts from ARP request. This ARP request is handled locally by the routing instance. It is not sent over the physical network, it's just proxy ARP. And once it responds with the correct MAC address to the VM1A of the destination machine it wants to access or connect with, then VM1 sends a packet. Because vRouter, the agent, actually knows where, because it has this information provided by this XMPP protocol from the controller, it knows that this VM is placed on the compute node 2, and that the compute node 2 vRouter allocates MPLS tag for his routing instance. And vRouter knows that he has to encapsulate the packet which was sent by VM, and it adds MPLS header with the correct MPLS tag and the gray header, and this all is encapsulated with the IP destination IP and source IP packet header of the physical network which connects those compute nodes. And the packet is transmitted over the physical network. In the compute node to receive the packet, he knows he is a destination, so it decapsulates the GRE header, and he gets the MPLS tag using which he decides which routing instance each packet should be forwarded next, where the IP prefix search is done, and correct VM is choose to, as a destination, and the packet reaches the VM on the compute node 2. And all the same is in opposite direction. This allows for complete isolation, decoupling the physical network and the virtual network. So none of the physical switches or routers have to be aware of any of the virtual network state. It doesn't have to know where the VM is spawned, in which virtual networks, what policies there are, and nothing of this information is necessary. Everything is held in the controller. The state of these virtual networks and this information is only held in the controller and is synchronized with these compute nodes. So in terms of development, what we have to do, we worked with on those two pieces, so vRouter and agent. And agent being user space applications required much less effort to do, but there were also some Linux is in there, so we have to implement some modules that didn't use IOCTLs, not present in FreeBSD or some parts which touched ProtFS. And we have to have a way to communicate with the vRouter. And original vRouter, this which works on Linux, uses Netlink for that purpose. So we, but it only uses Netlink in the way that they just use Netlink headers and nothing more. So we just implemented our, we called it fade Netlink, it's just a socket, and we use the Netlink headers to as a protocol to send and receive messages between agent and vRouter. It might look the build system. It also posed some problems because there are many things hard coded which doesn't work for FreeBSD. We decided for now to use GCC for building this for building agent, but our plan is to move and to switch to Clang for that purpose. vRouter, we had to do a complete port of vRouter because there are many differences, like ASCII buffs in Linux versus mbuffs, interrupts handling, callouts, etc., all this OS-specific stuff. However, authors of the vRouter make a design that allows quite easy for porting from one operating system to another operating system. So it also wasn't very, very difficult, but it took some time because of the bugs we had and this kind of things. So this is what we did, and this is what we want to do next. Because it is just we have just resolved the issues that prevented us prepare a cluster with which would handle networking with OpenContrail, and the first thing we have to do is to fix up all workarounds we have, improve the stability, and implement new features, like, because right now we only support MPLS over GRE tunnels, but Linux version also support MPLS over UDP or VXLANs. And of course we'd like to do some performance optimizations, but we haven't yet even had the time to do some benchmarking, so we don't even know how it behaves on the FreeBSD. It's really fresh development. And for the agent, we want to implement a listener module which is used to get information of the host networking, for instance, host routing tables and this kind of stuff. And they use Netlink, which is not available on FreeBSD, but we want to overcome this somehow. And the next step would be integration with the OpenContrail repositories, and what would actually make FreeBSD officially supported in the OpenContrail project. So making a summary of this all, there is still a lot of work to be done in this regard, but we at the moment can spawn some VMs using OpenStack on FreeBSD hosted compute nodes. We can provide simple networking via Nova network, or you can use more advanced features using the initial support for the OpenContrail solution. And we'll soon be all officially supported by OpenContrail project, because after cleaning up the code we do have, it will be integrated in the repositories, official repositories. And the next steps after this, we want to enable next nodes roles for FreeBSD. It should not be as difficult because we don't expect any. Those are just user space applications. We don't see there any OS specific things. It should not be very difficult. And actually, that's all I've got. If I still have access to my. I'll try to. Show you some cluster we do have in our lab. It's very fresh work because it was a day before I left for Canada to attend this conference. But when we finish. Okay, so we do have here OpenStack, and how could I show you that there are hypervisors, and the only the S1 is an S2 is based on Beehive, and what happened? It is, and I'll try to spawn some VMs on this. Here. Let's say this one. Private network, that's all. Hopefully we will launch soon. In the meantime, let's spawn yet another one. So also the same network. That's the spawning. Not yet, because we have no LibVirt doesn't allow for console output right now. We will see when we have networking set up between these VMs, and that's the way we can log into this. But those two have already spawned. They have private IP addresses visible. Oh, where is the console? Visible here is 10.0.0.253 and 10.0.0.254. And I don't know why that I can't see. Oh, sorry. Let's try to associate some floating IP. The floating IP is the IP available from the outside. So this is in the subnet of our lab. And that way we should have connectivity to this VM. Let me try to. If it's 10.0.101.253. It was. Yeah. So we gain access to this VM. Let's try to. 101.253. Yes. and yes, and we are here. But as you can see, the private address of this VM is 10.00. Where is the cursor? It's 10.0253. It's because vRouter take care of that, and because I associated the floating IPs, which is available from the outside, it just redirected me to this VM, and I should also ping the other VM, which was 254 from this VM, and yes, it is working. So this private network between those two VMs seems to work, and also the floating IPs from the outside via the gateway on the controller to the VMs in the private network. And this is actually the current state what we have when it comes to OpenStack and OpenController. And that's what I've got. So if anybody have some questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Yep. The connection between the
router
and the
virtual
machine, is it tap or
interface? Tap, yeah, yeah. At the moment there are taps.
And what's the status of the Netlink code?
We just pretend we are Netlink because
so you run on top of a standard socket?
Yeah, we have our own socket just it was this with vendor identification, if I remember correctly. But we just used the Netlink headers because the vRouter and the agent uses those headers, those type of those protocol which Netlink uses to communicate. But this is just a regular socket, and we only encapsulate everything with the same headers that Netlink on the Linux does, but we don't have any other functionality with Netlink. Once, if I know that probably.
Did you send a copy of the code or not?
Sorry?
I remember I sent a copy of the code to a couple of people.
Maybe. Yeah, but you sent it to not to me, to Greg. Yeah. 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 Okay, so thank you.
Hello, so that's the topic of my today talk. I'd like to present some idea that is already ongoing. So before I go into the gore details, I'd like to define the problem that we would like to address with this new idea. The problem that I call the configuration problem. So when we've got some region of memory that is read with a very high rate and that is edited quite rarely, like one time per second, one time per hour, or even one time per week. And we expect that it is read at a really high rate, like million times or more per second. An example of such thing is any configuration the kernel has in it, like local IP addresses hash that is looked up on every packet, interface list that also is looked up almost on every packet, a particular interface that can change during its lifetime, but its changes occur not very often. Firewall rules, no matter what the firewall is, PF or IPFW. What we right now use in FreeBSD for that problem? The most straightforward approach is read-write mutex or RWLock. And comparing to other mechanisms, what is important? That the acquiring thread is the releasing thread. So if we grab reading on the configuration, the same thread must exit reading mode. And RWLock is very expensive because all the readers, they do atomic memory store to increase the reader count, and then on exit they decrease the reader count. So we got a huge cache line contention on this word that represents the RWLock. Another more complex approach is read mostly lock. It doesn't use the atomic on for all threads on all the same memory region. It has much more complex design, but it still means that the acquiring thread is the releasing thread, and one of its downsides is that during the read operation, your thread is pinned to a particular CPU. What's wrong with that is that if you grab RMLock for a long time, like processing the whole firewall rules, and in the firewall you're about to grab some internal firewall mutex, and if that mutex is contested, then you're going to block sleep, and then and the CPU is released, and once the mutex is uncontested, you are allowed to run only on that CPU that you used when you did the RMLock enter operation. So right now this is not a very big problem, but I expect that when machines go to like several dozen of cores and you are pinned to one of them, that will probably be a problem, that you are allowed to run only on one of the 24 ports or one of the 46 processors you got. We also got ref count, so we can probably not lock the memory we are reading, simply ref count it. The good thing is that we can acquire ref count in one thread and later release the ref count in other thread. That is a good thing. But the bad thing is that ref count is still atomic operation. So what's wrong with these thread? They are quite expensive. How expensive they are? You probably, if you read FreeBSD.net mailing list, then you probably seen some emails from Alexander Chernikov. His FreeBSD login is Mailifier. And what they did at Yandex, they removed a lot of locking from our networking stack and to make the system not to panic immediately. They simply free the memory after several seconds of actual free operation. So just to allow all the threads that are accessing the configuration memory to yield. And they are achieving several times more packet per second performance than unpatched FreeBSD does. So removing these constraints is the aim of the the idea I'd like to present to you. Yeah, we also must mention RCU. The RCU model is a patented technology that is used in Linux, and when they moved a lot of their infrastructure to RCU, they got a lot of performance improvements in Linux kernel. But unfortunately, we can't use that because it's patented and... The first one expired, but they got the ongoing patents. So well, I don't want to focus on that because I'm little of time, but in short, the first patent that was from 80s, yes, it is expired. But there are later patents, and the blockable RCU is still covered. And that one is more interesting than the original one, because the original one actually means that when you RCU enter, you are in critical section. This is not very, there's a big constraint that we are, you can't take a mutex when you're in a critical section and so on. Yeah, and to mention that RCU is still, we cannot acquire reader in one thread and release in another. Why it is important for us to have the acquire not equal to releaser? For example, right now mbuffs reference ifnet interface structure. And right now, this is not reference counted. So on interface removal, right now we got a race. If we got a buff that outlives the interface member by a tiny amount of time, and we dereference the ifnet, and the ifnet is gone, we are accessing freed memory. Right now, we simply don't have protection against that. And any technique that says that acquire is equal to release can help us in this case, because the place where we allocate mbuf and the place where we free mbuf are absolutely different threads and different places in the kernel. So that's why we want to have acquire and not equal to releaser. So this sounds like, yeah, that's just what I said. The goal is that the reader operation can be as cheap as possible, and we don't care a lot about the expensiveness of the writing operation, because it occurs not very often. And this sounds like ref count, but implemented the other way. Before I start into the gore details of new idea, I must mention the new stuff we got in FreeBSD 10. This is a statistical counter that doesn't do contention on the cache line, because when you update this statistics provided by this facility, the update goes into the per CPU memory, so you are not trashing the cache line for the rest of the course. And IMD64, we got a very special optimization that makes it a single instruction without any critical sections, and that's the feature we are about to utilize right now. So what we want to do is to declare a structure that associates some pointer to the memory that will be the configuration memory and the counter. And we want that counter to account how many references we've got right now in the kernel to this pointer. We will provide interface for acquiring it that returns us the internal pointer from the LWR, increments the internal counter, and returns the pointer to the counter that we are about to reduce when we are no longer referencing the memory. And we will have a change function that can be as expensive as we wish, that because it will run not very often. It changes the old configuration pointer to new configuration pointer, allocates new counter, and it will free the old pointer and the old, and we have a special free function that is be of any kind. And the old counter, when it sees that there are no longer references in the old counter. And we, of course, want that the acquiring function still be very cheap, but thread safe against the changing function. So if we prototype the acquiring function, it's, as you see, the idea of it is very simple. We simply, as in the previous slide, increment, return counter, return pointer. And of course, this function is racy against anyone who is modifying LWR, because this, we have at least three instructions. And what the hypothetical changing function will do? It will update the contents of the LWR, and it must check that it doesn't clash with this function running right now on the other CPU. So how can we achieve that? This check that one CPU checks what other CPUs are doing. And what will we do if we detect this condition? So now going for the complex stuff. We will, to achieve the first thing, we will run our changer not on one CPU, but on all CPUs simultaneously. We will achieve that via SMP rendezvous interface that we already gotten from BSD kernel that stops all CPUs, they synchronize at one point, and then they all execute the same function. And then the CPU that initiated the rendezvous will return execution only when every other CPU has done its job. So this is how we will make the change. We will make some context on our stack, put the new values on the context, and then ask for rendezvous point that will initiate interprocessor interrupt. All CPUs will stop and execute an interrupt context, the actual change in function, which we will call the action function. And the action function, it will do assignment of the new pointers, new pointer, new ref count. And this code will execute on every CPU. So we have guarantee that all CPUs got their caches written through. So no stale data in any CPU cache. And after that, we must check what if our interprocessor interrupt happened right in the moment when the one of the CPUs was executing the acquiring function. So this is the complex case. What if our changed function interrupted the acquiring function? Yes. Actually, the problem is even more complex because not only the rendezvous API can interrupt the changing function. A timer interrupt also can. And if timer interrupts the acquiring function, and if scheduler decides to put the thread on run queue, it will be stored on run queue in the middle of the acquiring function, interrupted for some time. And we must handle this case too. So, before explaining the assembly, let's go back to this function. If we look at it carefully, we see that it does actually only one memory write, this counter 64 add. All other things are preparations. We are putting data in the return registers, and then we write to memory and return. So the non-recoverable operation is only one. And if we code our function in assembly and make this operation the last one, this is actually what counter 64 add means on AMD64. Then we make a function that can be restarted at any point from its beginning to this point, that is point of no return. So we first fill one of the returning registers, fill in the second return register, calculate the shift for the counter 64 add, and if we are interrupted here, 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 or here, we simply rewrite the instruction pointer to the beginning of the function, because it is safe. Because if we do a retry, no data is clobbered. We are simply updating data in registers. And only at this point we can no longer restart our function. Any questions at this point? Okay.
First of all, in the change action, you do the writes just to save a barrier or what?
The writes.
Yes.
To actually apply new pointers, and to make and we do that on every CPU to be sure that all CPU caches are written through.
Yeah, but then there is on the MD64 cache coherency, we guarantee that anyways. We guarantee that the cache is not stable.
So
I was wondering if you could do that the write in the before calling the SMP rendezvous. Anyway, something we can discuss later.
Yes, I can explain why running before rendezvous is not correct.
Okay.
So to declare the point of no return, we simply put a symbol between above red instruction, and we've got among the kernel symbols of the compiling kernel, we've got two of these symbols, the beginning of the function and its point of no return. And what is very important, this function is not inlineable. It exists in kernel in only one instance. So we want to roll back our function whenever it is interrupted at all, or whenever the change in function interrupted. So let's look at it. Okay, this. So option one, whenever an interrupt detects that it happened when the CPU was executing LWR acquire function, it must roll it back. This is achieved very simple. In the push frame macro, in the AMD64 code, on the trap handler, we simply add a couple of compares that the instruction pointer is not below the acquire start and not above acquire read. That's all. And if it is, then we assign it to the beginning of the function. The problem with that approach is that we are adding a few instructions per every interrupt. And this is a tiny but still overhead. A more complex approach is that we want that the SMP rendezvous itself detects that it had interrupted the acquiring function. To achieve that, we look two frames back into the stack and see the stack, the trap frame here. And we extract the instruction pointer from the trap frame and pass it to our fixing function. The fixing function, it simply again checks the boundaries. If it we got in the middle of these two symbols, then we fix up it to the first symbol. That's it. Very simple. But that is not enough, because we can have threads on scheduler run queues that were interrupted also in the middle of the LWR ref acquire. So in our scheduler, we need a new function that runs through the all threads on run queue and runs our function above them, on them. So one more handling that we must do in the SMP rendezvous is fix all run queues. The most simple version of the fix up run queue code looked like this, and this is actually not very correct because we rely on that the trap frame is three frames deeper than our current frame, And that is not always true. So I have written a simple stack unwinder. and this works. But the good news is that yesterday John have provided a hint to me that we actually store the information in the thread anytime the trap occurs. So I have not yet tested, but probably this unwinder is not needed. So what is the status of this stuff? This is all tested in my testbed. I have put a lot of extra instructions into the acquiring function just to make it more probable to get into its middle. Run a lot of tests. The fixing works quite well. So I'm always not leaking references, always returning the correct pair of the pointer into its counter. It never happens that have old pointer and new counter or vice versa. No production testing yet done. I hope to do that as soon as I return to Moscow and establish it with Alexander from Yandex. So stay tuned and what do you think about it?
Comment on the API. You
Wrote
a pointer and another argument as a parameter from the function. Could you just return the structure with both the counter reference?
I'd like to make the structure opaque to the users. Actually, we will have more stuff in it. We will have at least a mutex in it so that protect writer against writer, right? Maybe we'll have some call out there for garbage collection and so on. And I want that.
But I'm not saying to return the structure that you use for the internal information, just one structure that contains the two pieces that go together.
Ah, I understand. You mean that the prototype of the function will be not void.
But a structure
that consists of two.
Yes.
I have explored this case and I simply didn't find what the C ABI standard says on returning structures. It looks like some compilers, when you maybe you know. So when you declare a function to return a structure. In some cases, it will put the structure on the stack of the calling function, and the caller function will fill it, right?
It depends
on the size of the structure. Is there any standard saying that if the structure is above this length, then it is on stack?
It's part of the platform API, so for AMD64, small structures on FreeBSD are returned.
Yeah, so the question is how small? Because you see, I'm coding this function. Because I'm coding this in assembly, and I'm very likely to violate ABI, because there is no control over it.
Can you go back to the chain? Sorry, the one function, not this one, but the one before.
Actually, it's declaration in C. You mean? You see this function.
Oh, so you say you're coding the function.
You see this function is simply non-existent. This is the idea coded in C, but we can't code it in C because to be absolutely sure that it is restartable, so this is not the code I'm running. This is merely the idea. And to be absolutely sure that it is restartable, I must code it in assembly.
So you have a lot of complexity to work out when you've been interrupted by a timer. Why not just disable interrupts? On old CPUs, it was very expensive, but as far as I can make out from the Intel docs, anything later than Sandy Bridge is two cycles, to the same.
I'm not sure that it's that cheap. What do you think?
I went from their chips, I don't know that much.
Oh, you can test it. It's not a science. Yeah.
Well.
The other thing I would say is that Kirk had forwarded me a paper that
that had to do with these guys were trying to allow concurrent MFs and MMFs in different regions within all the threaded process so that you could have threads that were doing lots of mallocs and the mallocs and each thread could do different things. And so they had this thing where they used a ratings tree to replace what's the equivalent of like the VM map, like linked lists inside the interface. But in order to do this, they also made their own kind of lazy ref count thing, which is quite close to this, except that instead of doing something like this to free right away, they have a crazy scheme where they accumulate reference counts in a per CPU like collection of pending reference counts, and at fixed intervals, they kind of periodically push them out to the main row reference count.
Yes.
And then they have a way of detecting to make sure that when things go to zero, they're really zero, about kind of making sure they put things that go to zero on a per CPU watch list, and then when your timer goes off, you actually walk your per CPU watch list, and it has to kind of be zero for two cycles, and you know it's really, really unreferenced, and you can free it. But it works, and it has some of the same properties of being. It's very cheap, it's per CPU access during the time, you can coalesce if you do a quick free and like add and free or all per CPU accesses, you end up having a delta, you don't even have a delta to apply to the main thing so that you can go to the main cache line. That's in that paper I forwarded to.
Yeah, it also sounds like David F. Bacon's work on concurrent reference counts and concurrent cycle detectors. He's got a very similar algorithm but with some form of proofs of why it's correct. So there is a lot of literature in the area of high performance concurrent reference counts.
I'd appreciate any links.
David F. Bacon at IBM.
Can you send it via email, please?
Yeah, send me an email. I'm happy to look at it too. I'd really like the one. It reminds me a lot of the same type of thing. There's a little more complexity that you need this kind of pool of per CPU. Counters that you're kind of, they're like cache deltas relative to a global counter that, you know, per CPU, like fixed size pull up.
Yeah, well, we already got this per CPU counter. I mean that the current problem is how you update two pointers in a non-racy manner. So we already got the per CPU counter. Actually, this idea is not about, we already use ready per CPU counter. So the problem is, how do you update two pointers so that anyone reading them will always get a consistent copy of either two new old pointers or two old pointers?
Another level of indirection?
Hmm?
Another level of indirection? One pointer to a structure that contains the two pointers?
Well, that's maybe possible, but quite less cache friendly because this stuff we can embed right into the structure that we are about to reference. And one level of indirection gives us more jumping around the memory, less cache friendly.
Does your code currently handle interruption of a process by first a living ref is acquired? Acquirer is interrupted by, say, a clock interrupt, and then by the IPI?
We don't have embedded interrupts in FreeBSD. So when
clock
one.
Interrupt.
Huh?
Clock interrupt.
The clock interrupt is disabled while IPI is running.
Okay.
So we can't have one trap frame above another in FreeBSD. Not embedded, the nested was correct word. Thank you.